Hello?
Hello, Neo. Do you know who this is?
Morpheus.
Yes. I've been looking for you, Neo. I don't know if you're ready to see what I want to show you, but unfortunately you and I have run out of time.
What is happening to me?
You are the one, Neo.
Welcome to Now Playing's bonus The Matrix Retrospective Series.
Welcome back.
We missed you.
Hosted by Jacob.
You believe that you are special, but somehow the rules do not apply to you.
Stuart.
You got the gift, but it looks like you're waiting for something.
And Arnie.
Never send a human to do a machine's job.
This podcast will contain detailed plot spoilers and explicit language.
Are you sure you want to hear this?
Listener discretion is advised.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back.
Why? It'll be fun. I promise.
Today we're discussing The Matrix Reloaded, starring Keanu Reeves, Lawrence Fishburne, Carrie Ann Moss, Hugo Weaving, Harold Perrineau, Randall Duck Kim, Jada Pinkett Smith, and directed by the Wachowski brothers. I'm Arnie, and I'm not here because I'm free. I'm here because I'm the co-host of Now Playing.
Stuart in L.A.
And this is Jacob. And if you want to find the lipstick stains on me, well, don't look on my face.
I'm having a slice of chocolate cake right now just thinking about that, Jacob.
Does that mean you're turned on?
Uh-huh.
He's putting on the lipstick now. Oh, boy. Wow, we have a lot to talk about. We are discussing The Matrix Reloaded. And coming out in 2003 was kind of a weird year for me with films, but I think that this was one of the films I was most expecting that year, despite coming out of 99 a little bit lukewarm on the original. I mean, it was Freddy vs. Jason number one, this number two, X2 number three.
Of course. I think everyone agrees that Freddy vs. Jason was the film of 2003.
Hell, we reviewed it twice. It's so good.
Yeah, I can't recall every film I saw in 2003. I know this was at the top of my list. I went opening night. There was some gathering. I think it might have been a wedding reception I was at. And I'm like, see you later. Leaving early. Got to go see The Matrix Reloaded.
That is devotion. I actually, though, took an afternoon off work so I could watch The Matrix on DVD and have that very fresh in my mind when walking into the sequel, so who am I to judge?
And I couldn't have been colder. I saw The Matrix once, as I already said. I saw this only once, and I wanted to see it. I saw it within the first week that it opened. I enjoyed the first one well enough to want to see more, but maybe it helped the fact that I didn't have the first one in my mind. I remember after that first viewing, walking out and going, eh, it's okay. And then everyone I talked to that summer was like, did you see The Matrix? Oh my God.
I will say I had only seen it once. This was my second viewing for this podcast. I saw it that night. We'll discuss what I thought. I saw it again last week.
And yeah, of course, as the fan, I've seen this one multiple times. I think to talk about this one, it would be tough if this was a weekend of release review for us.
Now, I gotta wonder, Arnie, I'm gonna throw this out here. I know you're a big Star Wars person. Is maybe some of your whole rivalry, I do think back in 1999, maybe some of the reason why you were resistant to jack into this Matrix was that you wanted to only be obsessed with one sci-fi franchise. And the Wachowskis, let's face it, they're kinda cribbing in on Lucas territory here by planning so big a year in which they're releasing video games and animated spin-offs and two sequels in the same year. I mean, they're definitely crafting a business plan that I haven't seen since the first Star Wars.
Well, at this point, that was pretty par for the course. I mean, this was the year the third Lord of the Rings came out. Back to the Future 2 and 3 were shot back to back. I just kind of thought this was rare, but it certainly wasn't unheard of. I mean, hell, they even tried that with Superman 1 and 2. So I can't say that's the case. I do think in 99, part of my resistance was that I was afraid that 99, which should be the year of Episode 1, might have been overshadowed by a new, younger, cooler brother.
It was at the Oscars. I mean, I was stunned. I lost the Oscar pool that year because I said, oh, Star Wars is definitely going to win visual effects. Nope. Matrix took it right away, and everyone else said I was stupid for thinking Lucas was going to win. It was starting to look like this was the hipper, younger, sexier Star Wars.
But by 2003, I was ready to accept the Matrix. I've never been just a one franchise kind of guy. It's the one-to-one argument. It's what I said when we did our Spider-Man 2002 review. I just want Star Wars to be number one, but that doesn't mean others can't succeed. And so I wasn't resistant at all when The Matrix 2 came out. I'd gone back and revisited or reloaded The Matrix into my DVD player several times, and it was one of those films that did take a little while to grow on me, that first one. And the more I saw it, the more I was able to go with that world and be a little less resistant. And so when this came out, no, there was absolutely no Star Wars bias on my part. I mean, I wouldn't have gone opening night, given them 20-some-odd dollars, me and my wife going for tickets, if I didn't want this film to be good and succeed.
Well, it's definitely ambitious. I can't think of anybody for their second one. I mean, it's one thing, Lord of the Rings, I mean, it was a trilogy. There was a blueprint there. But this is an original story being crafted, and these guys got greenlit, not just for two sequels that would come out one at a time, everything. They went all in. And it seems to me, watching this one, I guess we'll get into it as we get into the plot, but it seems like there are a lot of digressions in this reloaded movie that probably are explainable in other media. That if things don't make sense here, and there are definitely things that I'm curious and uncertain about, that if I went and played Enter the Matrix or watched the Animatrix, I would know a little bit more information about. It seems to me like they didn't just design a sequel story. They wanted to build a universe in 4 years. Well, I guess we can discuss whether they did it well or not. Arnie, why don't we start with that plot?
It's been 6 months since Neo, played by Keanu Reeves, was rescued from the Matrix and revealed to be the One. A man who could do whatever he wanted in the Matrix, including fly and stop bullets. And in that 6 months, the man versus machine war has raged on, with more humans awakening in the past 6 months than long before. However, the machines are making a move to end the war. A large drill is positioned right above Zion, the last human city, and it plans to drill down, setting loose thousands of killer sentinel robots, extinguishing the human race. And in Zion, there is dissent. See, in the last film, we only saw the crew of the Nebuchadnezzar, led by Morpheus, Lawrence Fishburne, and Trinity, Carrie Ann Moss, all of whom believe the Oracle's prophecy of the One. But in the last human city, things are more conflicted. We have a new character, played by Henry Lennox. And his character, Commander Locke, doesn't believe in the mysticism of the Oracle. He only believes that they need to gather every ship they have to fight off the machines. So he really chafes when Zion Elder Counselor Hammond, played by character actor Anthony Zerbe, sides with Morpheus, ordering the Nebuchadnezzar out to make contact with the Matrix and the Oracle. And when the Nebuchadnezzar doesn't come back, Herman asks for two more captains to volunteer to take their ships to find Neo and Morpheus, taking Locke's fleet down by three. Those volunteers are Captain Roland and Captain Niobe, played by Jada Pinkett Smith, who happens to be Locke's girlfriend and Morpheus's ex-girlfriend. Alright, following me on this?
Only because I've seen the movie twice, but yeah, keep going.
It's dense, and it's going to get denser. See, the Matrix hasn't been the same since Neo became the One. At the end of the last movie, he jumped into the body of Agent Smith, played by Hugo Weaving, who was a program that hunted down rebels in the Matrix. But that combination has made Agent Smith go rogue, and he started to take over the Matrix by duplicating himself, taking over all others he encounters. He even takes over one rebel named Bane. No, we're not discussing Batman again. And when Bane leaves the Matrix, Agent Smith has taken over the man's body in the real world. But Neo goes to see the Oracle, who tells Neo he must go to the source of the Matrix. Alright, now there's a lot to this. We're going to go into it in the podcast, but there's a keymaker, he has to unlock a door, but he's held captive by a French information broker called the Merovingian, his spurned wife Persephone, and some Rastafarian albino ghost twins, a shitload of fighting, a highway chase. It all ends with a three-pronged attack, where the three captains must all execute a plan to cut all power to the Matrix City while Neo infiltrates the source. There, Neo meets the Architect, a personification of the program that built the Matrix. Here he drops some serious shit. Neo is not the One, he's the sixth one. The Matrix code works for 99% of all humans, but eventually the code generates a bug. And alright, let me put this in terms you can understand. Most of us run Microsoft Windows, right? And you know how you boot your system and it works for a while, but you let it go too long, there's some memory leaks, you need to reboot the system? The Matrix must be a Microsoft product, because every time the One shows up, it's a bug that says it's time to reboot the Matrix, which actually involves the machines wiping out Zion, killing every human there. And they've done this 6 times now. The One, whoever happens to be the One this time, must choose some humans from the Matrix to be released to restart the human race as a rebellion. And if Neo refuses this, then the Matrix is going to crash, killing every human plugged into it. Basically, genocide of the entire human race. But Neo does refuse because he loves Trinity, who was mortally wounded while working to cut power to the city. But since Neo is the One, he's able to magically resurrect her and bring her back to life. Meanwhile, in the real world, Sentinels destroy the Nebuchadnezzar, though Morpheus and everyone else escapes when Neo raises his hand and, I have to stress, in the real world, causes Sentinels to cease functioning, although this effort puts Neo in a coma. Also in a coma is Bane, the only survivor from another ship that was destroyed when its EMP fired too early under mysterious circumstances. Bane will have some explaining to do in part 3, but we have to wait a few months for that as credits roll. So there's a ton to discuss. This movie is dense. I can't possibly summarize it in detail. If you need the details, well, that's what the show is for.
Well, since there is so much to discuss, the one I'd like to start with first is the new element, Zion. I didn't remember, after the first viewing, anything about this city. We were told, but never shown, anything in the Matrix that there was this, like, human resistance city. I kind of just thought it might be a fort, you know, with some, like, boards nailed up and, like, a couple people there with, like, a couple guns or something. I had no idea we were talking about a vast cave techno orgy. This is a stunner for me. Right from the get-go, I will just say this up front. Reloaded does almost nothing that I would expect after watching the first movie. And this is one of the big ones. Like, I just did not think that this is what humans would be doing and living like once they got out of the Matrix.
Yeah, it's dropped early on while they're meeting in the Matrix that there's 250,000 Sentinels coming to destroy Zion, one for every man, woman, and child. So here's 250,000 people living in Zion. That's pretty significant, especially when we'll learn that that was all spawned by 23 people. So I'm not sure what the math is to figure out how long that would take, but yeah, Zion is bigger than I would expect.
It's about the size of St. Louis. I mean, it's not huge, but...
For living in caves underground, yeah, they're doing pretty good.
I can't imagine what the line to the bathroom is all I'm saying. I just feel like there are some logistical issues with housing, feeding, providing for that many people. I just didn't think it was going to be that big. Everything about the last movie, it felt like it was them against the world, right? Like there was just 6 people in a ship, and that was all that there was to keep humanity alive. By making it so many people now, it kind of makes Neo seem less special. To me, anyway, I feel like the focus gets lost. He's no longer the one to pay attention to because there are so many other people, so many other characters and storylines in Zion.
And I would argue that's probably part of the Wachowski's point here is, again, when we get to the end of the film, that's going to become very clear. But yeah, right away, he doesn't seem like that confident Jesus that we saw flying around and making those hacker calls at the end of the Matrix. Here, he seems much more unsure about himself. I hate the costuming for Neo in this film.
Oh, I love that. It's like a monk outfit. I think it looks cool with the Mandarin collar.
He just looks so stiff in it.
It's an improvement. The John Cusack coat had to go. It's not say anything anymore. We're gone with the 80s.
Trinity, every time she's in the Matrix, let your hair out, baby. Don't slick it down. You look so hard and unattractive. You look better when you're dirty and Zion.
Well, am I the only one, though, who really, in this entire movie, finds it so overstuffed that the only people I can care about are the ones from the last movie? I mean, we are introduced to so many people in Zion, so many new characters, and because of that, they all get so little screen time that anytime we're not focused on Neo, Trinity, and Morpheus, I'm like struggling to keep up and find a likable quality in any of these other people. Certainly in the last one, because it was 7 people against the world and they were 7 people, all of whom we could get to know, that's a manageable cast size. And hell, we didn't even talk about like 4 of them because we didn't even care about them that much. It's like the entire city of Zion is made up of people like Switch and Apoc.
there's something that fails. Maybe it is because there's so many people, but you get this new character, Link, Dozer and Tank's brother-in-law. And he has a relationship with his wife, Z, and they try to do this very touching thing where she's upset that he's going off with Morpheus and she's left alone. And conceptually, I like this idea. You know, we talked a little bit about this with the last film, but this African-American family unit, it's shown in a positive way. That's great. It's just, it all falls flat. I find myself not connecting with anyone, but again, those main characters that we talked about last time, not because anything here is necessarily bad. I just don't think it's written very well to grip me and get me to get invested in Link or the kid or Bane or Locke or any of these multiple characters.
Well, Link's an interesting case. Would you have felt better if he was named Tank? Because he was originally.
What happened to Tank? That's exactly it.
Here's the thing. The out of story reason is he wanted more money and the Wachowski said no. I think they were so ticked off by him. There's nothing in the lore that I've looked at. There's a Matrix wiki. I went on there trying to figure out, was there some, because there was comics, there were video games. Was he killed in one of those? Nope. He just disappeared. He just died somehow between these films. And they're not going to tell you how, because they were pissed off that he held out for more money.
Yeah, it's actually got really fucking dirty. I did some Googling because I was surprised that wiki, Matrix wiki, IMDb, no reference of this. But you know, when things get litigious, it gets a little bit hairier to report on them. So, allegedly, rumor has it that his contract said he'd get paid $150,000. He wanted $250,000. Wachowski told you, go fuck yourself. Allegedly, he then stalked the Wachowskis, started crank calling them in the middle of the night, and even broke into their private studios. Allegedly, he then wrote a letter apologizing that got leaked to the internet where he said he'd work for free.
Oh, geez.
Because he wants to be part of this universe.
And because he doesn't have another job. I haven't ever seen him again.
Well, allegedly, the Wachowskis blackballed him and labeled him a terrorist. And so, not allegedly, this is true, he sued their asses for defamation and lost salary.
Wow.
And they settled out of court, and with a settlement that all the lawyer said is the actor who played Tank was very happy, but the details were not disclosed.
Well, you know, be that as it may, I understand that relationships crumble and, okay, they don't want to work together. They could have recast. They could have thrown a line in and said, Tank got killed on another mission.
Oh, they did exactly that. They recast and made it Link, and they said, I've lost two brothers.
No, that's not a recast.
Well, they said, I've lost two brothers, so Tank is dead and Link is his brother-in-law.
Yeah, but come on. I mean, we wanted that. We had some emotional involvement with Tank. It's starting us on a really bad foot with Link. For us to see that he doesn't trust the crew, and yet he feels like he has to do it out of allegiance.
So you're saying he's the weakest Link?
No, I'm definitely not, because I like Harold Perrineau. He was in a little indie movie called Smoke that I thought he did a really good job in, about Harvey Keitel in a cigar smoke shop.
I like him from Lost, and of course we discussed him for Donors on the 28 Weeks Later podcast.
Right, yeah, I mean, he's consistently worked and been good. I think he brings something different here. I think what's a throw-off is that if you want to replace Tank, you would bring someone that's a little more macho, a little more action. This guy is like a working family man type. He's giving a more dramatic performance than I think we would have gotten from somebody named Tank. And I don't know whether that's good or bad, but it doesn't work as a substitute. It left me questioning why I should like this guy when we had this other character with unresolved storylines.
And Tank wasn't the only one who got replaced. So did Z.
Yeah, I did know about this one. I thought I had remembered Aaliyah, the singer, was having a burgeoning action movie career. She was in Romeo Was Bleeding. I thought she was cast in this, but they had to cut her out. They had to refilm her with Nona Gay. She is Z.
Yeah, I remember all of that occurring at the time. Like I said, I was really into the making of this. I wasn't a big Aaliyah music fan, but I liked her in Queen of the Damned.
Picky, picky, baby girl. She's all right.
Well, there is just so much going on down here in Zion, and it's not what I expected, and I certainly think that this is proof that the Wachowskis can't go on and pull a Lucas, where Lucas is like, well, in 1974, when I was writing this, I knew Luke and Leia were brother and sister and Vader was their father, when, yeah, bullshit. Here, nothing in the first movie alluded to this. 100% of the rebels we see believe in the prophecy, the oracle, the one. They seem very unified. It seems very Star Wars, Rebels against Empire, and now all of a sudden we're going to start adding political intrigue and factions into this rebellion, and also doing the exact same thing for the machines. It's like, I thought we were having good versus evil, but now we've got like three sides of good and three sides of evil, which is exactly how the online massively multi role-player game did it.
Yeah, I researched that game for this podcast, and man, the number of factions. You had the Cypherists, you know, people that wanted to get plugged back into the Matrix. There's so many factions.
But you see them all in this movie, is the funny thing, is they weren't just bullshitting. It's all right here in the Matrix Overstuffed and Reloaded.
I like this overstuffing. I like that you get to Zion, and it's not all about computer Jesus, that there are skeptics. There are people that just want to defeat these robots and they don't need computer Jesus or believe in him even. I like that this feels like a world to me that, hey, here's this problem. You're going to have religious nuts. You're going to have war hawks. This feels more three-dimensional. That last film, I always had this uncomfortable feeling. It's too Campbellian. It's too based on that Messiah idea that which I think the Wachowskis try to undermine in that film. I felt there was a bit of that. But here I feel it more, and I like that. I like that this isn't black and white, that there's a lot more going on here.
Yeah, but you've got to admit, it would be very strange to come back to Empire Strikes Back and find that Luke is barely in the movie and sulking about and not the star. I mean,
if the whole thing was Major Brender Lynn discussing the correct ways to attack the Empire with General Madine, I think that would be a very different film.
Yeah, and I don't know what you just said, but I agree with you. Because I don't know who those characters are. And that's exactly my point, is I feel like what's thrust upon us are people like Niobe, who, you know, I like Jada Pinkett Smith. She's got sass, she's got fun, but not here. I mean, I don't really understand. I feel like every character is defined by their outfit. And while they may have some cool styles to them, why should I care that she and Morpheus had something before he went off and got all religious, and now she's married to this stick in the mud who doesn't like him either?
I'm not saying that this is done perfect at all.
Is it done well?
Well, it will get done well later on. This whole opening, you know, is cold to me. I'm not instantly enthralled into it like I was with that first Matrix film from that first crane kick that we see Trinity do. Here, I mean, when we see all these different red pills, as the mythology calls them, all these rebels inside the Matrix, and again, they're all in leather and sunglasses. I want to see someone whose residual self is like just wearing sweatpants and flip-flops. And like, that's my cool self. Yeah, this just seems like a huge data dump. Hey, there's 250 Sentinels drilling down. We have this much time. We got to get these ships back here. This ship's going to be allowed to stay for this long to try to contact the Oracle. I don't think it's very engaging at the beginning. I like that throughout this film that they are expanding on the ideas that this is not a black and white story. This is not machines bad, humans good.
Yeah, that's the thing I hang on in this first act, is that there's an irony to Zion, and that is it's run by machines. I don't know what I thought Zion would be like, but I presumed that if we were going to a cave, it would be stone tools, that there wouldn't be a single machine apparatus. But no, they've got cogs and wheels and an engine room and all of these things. They are reliant on machines, just as the machines are reliant on human beings above ground for the battery power. It's a yin and yang. They're going for something here. One cannot go without the other.
I even was thinking about that in the first one, how the Nebuchadnezzar is a machine. And so humans, despite having created the ultimate machine, which is damning them, are still using machines. It's like they didn't learn. Now, I will say this. I'm going to split the difference down between where the two of you are coming from. I don't think this is necessarily done well, but I see completely what it's doing, only because I remembered rewatching part two, how part three ended. The first time I'm watching this, I remember being bored to shit. But now, knowing how it ends in part three, and fuck it, I'm gonna spoil it. It ends with a truce. It doesn't end with the Empire being destroyed by the Rebellion, which is, because I was always equating this so closely to Star Wars, what I expected. But knowing that it ended on what I originally considered to be a very unsatisfying truce ending, not what I wanted, then now I see they really built this, and I was just ignoring them. all through part two, there's this whole scene of Neo and this counselor going through the engine room discussing how machines need man and man needs machines and all this. And I'm like, okay, what they're doing is pleading their case, not for annihilation of either side, but for peace. They're building this here so that when the ending finally comes at the end of the next movie, it all feels right. And now that I see it coming, okay, I accept it more. But the very first time I watched this movie, it was a bunch of talking heads and I wanted some ninja kicking.
You know what's funny, Artie? You complained last time with some of that obvious dialogue. You're my own personal Jesus Christ and you need to unplug. I kind of hate this conversation that Neo has with Counselor Holland. Like, it is so goddamn obvious. Like, I know the machines and humans are relying on each other. You have showed me that multiple times in Zion at the beginning of this film that they're going to spend 5 minutes making it painfully obvious. Like, I like philosophy. I think that's why I enjoy these films for the level of discussion that they go down into for a typical sci-fi action film. But come on, this is obvious. I get it. I wish there was some subtlety here because, yeah, it is kind of boring. There's just a lot of talking. And whereas with the first Matrix film, there's a ton of exposition. That stuff is fascinating. The way Morpheus delivers it and just the ideas they're getting into here, it's just not as engaging at the beginning.
I don't attribute that to the talking about the world. I think that stuff is good. I think you guys are a little tough about what you're calling obvious metaphor. I think it's cool that this movie wants to make a metaphor that everyone could see, all age groups. That's fine. It reminded me of Metropolis, actually, if you've ever gone back and seen
yes.
that Fritz Lang 1925 movie, which is a good movie. I watched it recently. It holds up, but it really talked about a society where the different caste systems were all part of the same thing. And they're doing that here, that machines and human beings are two different classes that don't get along. And so, yeah, it will be about them forming a truce, not one kicking the other's ass. I think that's all good. But you did establish an ass kicker, and what's weird to me is what they have done to Neo, and particularly what they have done to Trinity, a character I really responded to last time, and who now, you tell me her character arc. I think it's to sit there and look mopey for the whole movie. With the exception of this death scenario that is a dream for most of the movie, she's miserable in this movie. I don't mean the performance, I mean the character.
Their entire relationship is absolutely like one of the most stereotypical saccharine relationships on film. They had this whole kind of her pining for him last time and he had to die and become the one. And at the end they kissed and it was grand. And this is why rom-coms never get sequels, right? Because you just don't want to see the sickening happy couple now making out at every opportunity with no drama. It was really their relationship. I can't believe I was rooting for it in the last one because here it's just way too lovey-dovey and very uninteresting. I mean, again, I get what they're setting up here so that it's tragic that Trinity may die in this one and whatever happens in the next one, but it's not working for me because anytime these two are on screen together, I don't see any chemistry.
And I do think that's a problem because so much of this story, what Neo is going to decide at the end is based on a very specific love, his love for Trinity. And, you know, there's another scene I'm sure we'll talk about with the kiss where it's supposed to be like a big betrayal of Trinity's love. I don't ever really feel it like I think I should feel it. Like it really should feel like it should be emotional. And for whatever reason, you know, they're super horny at the beginning and they want to make out and have sex. That's all I get off of it. I don't get romance.
I don't think you get it because I don't think the Wachowskis believe in it. I think they're right-brained people. I think that they like the ideas of the science fiction. And when it comes to the emotional investment, it's just not what they're good at. It's not how they experience the movie. So yeah, when we have love scenes, there are people saying, I love you. I mean, they're horrible. The worst things about this iteration are these scenes between Neo and Trinity. I hate to say it, but it almost plays like Trinity has neutered Neo. Because they are both so miserable, it's like this woman has ruined him and she needs to die so that he can go back to being the ass kicker that we liked. So I'm not worried when he's having all these dreams about her dying. I'm like wondering, yeah, when? I'm looking at my watch.
Well, that's how the movie started too. I mean, just like the first movie, this movie starts with Trinity doing a solo mission in the Matrix, doing her little ninja kicks, but whereas the last time she escaped, here is the big shock. We see her get shot and plummet down and hit a car. So we know from the very first scene that's supposed to be the big cliffhanger is Trinity going to die? But unfortunately, and I blame the actors more than the writing and the directing, I think that these two just end up not having any chemistry on screen. They do not seem to be at all interested in each other, despite how lovey-dovey they're kissing and making goo-goo eyes. I'm not buying it in their performance, in their body language. I'm being told it. I don't believe it. And so, yeah, I do not care if Trinity lives or dies in this one. She has become a very useless character, but not quite as useless as Morpheus. Morpheus gets to kick off a party and then basically just shuttle Neo around this movie. He's the bus driver.
Hey, he gets to do the remake of The Warriors. Can you dig it? I mean, this callback, this whole party thing. I remember this was always something that people wanted to discuss when they wanted to discuss how much they didn't like this movie that summer that it came out, was that why did they spend so much time on them dancing? This scene was eternal for them, and that something had gone wrong with showing a party. I don't know. I don't think it's that long. It's about 5 minutes, but when the movie is lagging and you don't feel like you know where it's going, that can be eternal, but I get where they're coming from. It's a strange emphasis on a movie that used to be about action to now be about sexuality and dancing.
Well, I do love this. I don't love Morpheus's delivery of this speech. I don't know. There is something funky with his delivery. I know that there was actually about 2,000 extras in this fake cave, and he actually yelled to give this performance, but there's something about the way he pronounces it. It doesn't work for me.
I'm right there with you. His cadence is off. There's something about it, and it's strange that we're both picking on this, but that speech, I wasn't roused. I certainly wasn't turned on like all the Zionists.
For 100 years, we have fought these machines.
Yes, exactly. It was, I mean, maybe if you really were shouting without a microphone, they've got every fucking machine in the world but an amp.
But I do love this dancing. There's something, I think this is the first moment where I really get into this film, you know. If you look at what The Matrix represents, the mind and ideas, and you look at what Zion represents, you know, the physical world, bodies, I do love that there is this celebration of the body at the beginning of this. Forget all these talks about how we're depending on machines and we're going to fight them and there's going to be war. Like, yeah, here is the physical world, the body, and here's a celebration of it. All these different races and jumping around and dancing, there's something very tribal about it. If you want to get across what is Zion about, here's this scene that tells you perfectly. I didn't have to go through all that exposition to get here.
I didn't mind this scene this time either. I do think in theaters, because of how it came about, because of what preceded it, where really, again, our only action scene was Trinity getting shot and one minor thing with Smith, but there's so much talking, so much exposition, that when this speech comes at about the 30-minute mark, I'm just starting to feel unfulfilled. But watching it the second time, I remembered this actually as being a much dirtier orgy than it was. I was surprised that just about everybody kept their shirts on. I realized, I think I was now thinking of some dance party from part three where there were a lot of nipples.
I appreciate that they've made room for sensuality. You know, it's always a complaint that the MPA, you know, they're cool with violence, they're not cool with nudity and sex and all of that. If this is an R-rated movie, why can't we spend a little bit of time on sex if we spend all the time we do on action and violence? My problem is it's cheesy sensuality. I mentioned last time in the Animatrix, that scene between Jew and Thaddeus kind of came off as like a commercial you'd see about perfume from the 80s. This is how it's reading to me. Again, I think the Wachowskis are not who you get when you want to have deep emotional feelings coming through on screen. They're cool techno-minded individuals. They get the science fiction part. They get the action. But I don't feel like even if you went back and watched The Matrix, you would find it to be a particularly moving story. It's just not what they do well. And so what's the problem for me is that's what this first act needs to be about, and they're just not able to pull it off.
What you're saying is they're more architect than Oracle. We need more Oracle at the beginning here.
Indeed. And we do finally get to the Oracle. Once we get to Act 2. She finally responds. She's been missing. Nobody knows why. I still don't know why she went missing, but these guys come back with a microchip or something, and it's all of this game of trying to find her in hiding, but first they have to face off with Seraph.
And this is where we get the idea that there's something different with going on with the code. We see, I guess, Neo Vision, because he could see the code now. And this time, Seraph, when he looks at him, he's gold. He's not that green color. again, they're expanding the mythology here.
I didn't understand why that mattered. What was that meaning?
I believe the gold, I mean, we'll see it a whole lot in the next film, but I think that's what signifies something is a program. It's not just code going by. It's an actual program manipulating things around it.
It's not a natural part of the Matrix. It's a different program. And yeah, at the end of the first one, we got that brief glimpse of where Neo sees the agents and the whole Matrix in that Matrix lettering, like he was looking at the monitors on the outside. I never realized that that's how he saw it from that moment on. He never saw color or anything else. He just always saw that. And when he saw Seraph, he saw a program.
Okay. I'm glad you guys can explain that. It was not clear to me. I have another question, too, since we're talking about logistics. But I didn't think about this in the first movie. But here it was readily apparent. They have to drive somewhere if they want to go into the Matrix. They have to get into a ship and drive somewhere, and then they can jack in. Why can't they just jack in from Zion?
They have to get to broadcast level. It's something, I don't know, gobbledygook. They got to tap into hard lines or whatever. They can't do it from Zion.
They're deep underground, so that explains it for me. Is they're deep underground, and they're using a cell phone. There's no signal. They're in a dead zone down there.
I can understand that. That makes sense. I mean, maybe they should get a can with a string on it, and maybe they could run a line to the city. It just seems like they're putting themselves in an awful lot of danger, driving up to where sentinels are flying around, and then going into a trance where they won't know whether they're being attacked or not.
Well, that's why you have someone like Link that's still awake and watching everything.
Right, the Uhura of this franchise, yes. Okay.
I do wish, though, because one of the early scenes here is Morpheus getting together with Niobe and some others in the Matrix. I wish there'd been just some scene there that indicated in the first movie that there was a bigger rebellion going on, because in the last movie, it did feel so Six Men Against the World. Now, it's like, all of a sudden, we can have these meetups, we could just make tons of phone calls. It just felt so much bigger this time that it didn't feel, in many ways, like the same Matrix.
And I do think that might be because of Neo. There's a line that Morpheus drops that they've freed more minds in the last 6 months than they have in the last 6 years. I think the operations have gotten bigger. They've gotten bolder now that they have the One.
Maybe that's why Zion has been discovered, too, because, I mean, they could have drilled for this 100 years ago, right? They could have stopped Zion before they built this whole cave apparatus.
But that's the end twist. They could have destroyed Zion before Zion ever begins. They choose to allow Zion to exist.
Right.
We gotta talk about that at the end. But don't try to come up with logistics for why the robots didn't kill him earlier or why they're killing him now. That's all given to us in a scene I watched 7 times.
Okay. There's only been 6 reboots of the Matrix, though. You watched it one extra.
And I still won't understand it after all of that viewing, but I appreciate that you will be able to answer a lot of those questions when I get to them. Okay. But right now, it's all about finding the Oracle, because Morpheus, and I suppose Neo, has put all of their stock in the fact that she's the only answer to solving this problem of Sentinels invading their city. That's the only one that can do anything about it. And then they get there and she talks in fortune cookie.
Well, that's what an oracle does, Stuart. I'd expect nothing less. But here we get this whole thing, and it is a continuation of the theme from the first one. And I didn't even catch this the first time I watched these movies, but the whole thing about choice, people are going to do what they're going to do. In the last one, Neo had to make his choice, red pill or blue pill. Here, it's all about choice. The Oracle can't give you a mission to go fulfill. The Oracle can set you up with choices and point you in the right direction. But the key is, since the Oracle is a program coming from the machines, is she lying? Is she setting them all up? Is she part of the mechanism that exists to kill everyone every 100 years or so?
Yeah, Stuart, you suspected maybe there was something up with the Oracle in the last film, but here it's made obvious. She is a program. She is not human.
Right.
I love that twist. How much can you trust her? Now, she is a lovely grandmother. You talk about heart and emotion. Here's the one character that bleeds it. Just love every time she's on the screen in the last film and this one.
Her delivery is tremendous. I love how every line comes off so kindly. I mean,
yeah, I wish she was my grandma.
In a way, it's kind of a stereotypical performance, but on the other hand, I really do like this actress.
And I do like that. Here's the twist. She might be an evil machine. She might be trying to kill all of you.
It's at this moment that, yes, I do appreciate that they have illuminated what I suspected might be the root of the Oracle, why she couldn't leave the Matrix. She's a program with inside it. Doesn't it just feel like the Wachowskis, every time they come up with an idea about where to go with this, they talk themselves out? It's like, oh, here's an Oracle, and this is a character that can guide Neo into being who he's supposed to be. Or no, or maybe she's just a different system of control and we shouldn't listen to her. I feel like while it's okay to add gray and dimension and to, you know, make things not black and white, I'd also like to know where the story is supposed to go. I want to know what Neo is supposed to do, and this waffling is what I'll call it, about whether she's good or bad, or whether he'll follow or not, or whether it matters or not, is starting to become irksome.
Well, I'm gonna disagree. I like the mystery, because the Oracle is almost too powerful with all of her foresight. And if she is a program and not able to leave, I think that given that, again, black and white man versus machine, I like that it becomes about choice. Do you choose to believe her? I much prefer that than just having a lawful good character who's never going to possibly betray you. In this movie that's a lot about shades of gray, I like that they smudge her up a bit.
I would like for some person to answer a question bluntly when asked, is what it really is. Hey, we need help with all of these robots that are coming to attack, and she sends them off to find some key maker.
That is my problem with the Oracle in this movie, is basically, it does feel like a video game where you go to this person who gives you your mission, and you have to go through these hallways and find this key maker, but to do that, you have to see the Merrill Lynchian. I couldn't understand what they were saying. I thought it was a Merrill Lynch ad. I just put in my notes the Merrill Lynchian.
You know, Stuart, I do wonder, because I don't think you're typically the action fan or maybe the sci-fi fan, that you maybe want a more rote story. I know a lot of people that didn't like these sequels. They're like, where's my kung fu? Where's my shoot 'em up? Why are we getting all these ideas? I think if this was a drama about these kind of ambiguous relationships and that, maybe you'd be more into that. And that's what I'm liking, that this is not your typical action film, that they aren't going to give you answers, that there is mystery behind it. That's, again, for as much as I really did enjoy that first act, this is what's keeping me going. Now, I do agree, Arnie, this does feel very video game. Once she does give some answers, you got to go to this person and get this thing and then go here into this building and unlock this door. That's not so great, but if this is a story about know thyself, well, you can't just tell the person what they are. You have to guide them and so they discover themselves.
Yeah, okay. I get it. And it's not like I dislike that as a concept. I like the concept. What they seem to be implying here, there's some lip service to the idea that everyone has one purpose in a larger story. So they've written this storyline in which they go and there's a person that does one thing for them and it allows them to do something else. Conceptually, I like the idea that ideas live beyond the people that do the accomplishments, but I also think it's terrible screenwriting to have characters go from place to place to place with nobody growing or changing or knowing what the fuck is going on. I do not know what Neo is supposed to be doing, and I do feel like we should have some inkling.
I think that what they're trying to do is really set us up. Again, this whole movie, especially that first act, is about setting your expectations. And the first act is about setting our expectations for how the war is going to end. The second act is about setting our expectations for Neo and the One. We called him Computer Jesus, and now he's come around to the fact that he ain't so special and he ain't in total control. And if it was just a M. Night Shyamalan twist at the end, it would feel like a cheat. But this movie does lead us to that. And it starts right here with this Oracle scene when we start realizing, yeah, he's not necessarily growing or changing. He's devolving and realizing he is not the flying Jesus that he started this movie as.
And again, I think that's the strong point of this film, deconstructing that Campbellian messiah myth. Again, there are some subtleties here. There's no one that tells Neo in this film, like, you're not my personal savior. But he expresses a lot of doubt about himself. He is not sure. You know, he tells Kid, we talked about him in the Animatrix, you know, I didn't save your life. You saved yourself. Many times he's like, I don't know. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. There's so much doubt here.
There's too much doubt here. There's too much doubt.
Well, I think if you have Jesus, and okay, he's an all-knowing God now, I think it's more interesting watching someone that's struggling with divinity, and hey, I know I'm supposed to be Jesus, but I don't know everything, and I don't know what it means to be Jesus and have this doubt.
Well, the problem is the last movie was about him dawning that consciousness that by the end of it, he really accepts, hey, I am the one. So I feel like if your point is to have him humbled, I feel like he needs to be really confident in this first half and feel like, yeah, I got this. Let me just talk to the Oracle. Hey, Oracle, you're not telling me what I need to know. And oh, by the way, when I finally get to the end of this, I'm not Superman. Great. But it's not playing that way. It's playing to me like both the characters on screen and the people making this movie don't really know what they're doing anymore. They don't know where they're going, and they don't know what they want to accomplish. And that uncertainty characterizes The Matrix Reloaded. It becomes about a succession of characters who are stalling to until they can figure out what it's all supposed to do.
Well, fuck all that. Let's have a fight. Finally, about 50 minutes into this, right after the Oracle scene, we can finally turn all that shit off. We can finally stop hypothesizing and preaching and having moral speeches. Let's bring Agent Smith in and duplicate him like he sat on a Xerox for an hour for a big fight against Neo.
A scene that I greatly enjoyed, yes. Even I'm not the action person, I was ready for this and deeply enjoyed it. Despite the fact that even in 2003, I recognized that these were some CGI creations, that they really did not have the technology to be doing what they're doing completely well.
I have to ask you, Jacob, is any of this real? Because I think that when the signpost fight specifically, when Neo grabs the signpost, it looks to me like a really good Xbox 360 game.
I felt like I was watching the final flight of the Osiris again. There are some painful CGI moments. No, but there is a lot of practical stuff here. Even with the Smiths, they had like 13 Smiths where they got guys with the same build as Hugo Weaving. Some were a little shorter, so they put lifts in their shoes, and because they all wear sunglasses, they just had these rubber masks with the sunglasses, so you couldn't tell from some of the faraway shots. But I was surprised how much technology they came up with for this. You know, watching them, oh, it's just CGI. That's nothing new. We're all used to that now. But no, they would scan in Hugo Weaving's face and Neo's face and digitally put them over these other bodies so they could get the same expressions. There's at times where it works for me. Other times when he's doing that spin with the signpost, that's painful for me. It just looks bad.
And they decide to put that in slow-mo so you can really gawk at the badness.
Yeah, you know, I do feel like part of this movie and both of these sequels are damned by having to upstage what they did in that first one, because that's the rule of a sequel, bigger and more, and so they got to come up with new ideas, you know, new bullet times. So yeah, they slow things down and let it go fast. Let our eye not catch how bad some of the CGI looks.
You know, you guys use the word bad. I'll just say that it's crude. The technology wasn't there yet. They didn't have the means to pull this off the way that they could now. It is not seamless, but that doesn't mean that I don't enjoy it. When I can recognize that something is an effect, it doesn't damn it to me. I still like this scene, despite the fact that tonally even, it doesn't seem to fit in with anything we've seen before. We've seen a couple fights, you know, he sparred with some agents earlier, and he did fight with Seraph, which was a pretty good fight too, but we've been waiting for a big set piece. We've been waiting for the bullet time, and I'm relieved that it's here, even if it's Looney Tunes. I mean, even if there's bowling pin sounds when he's knocking them all down.
I do kind of like that.
You do nail it on the head with Looney Tunes, because I do enjoy the scene a lot. I think it's a really fun fight. I love that the Smiths keep coming. But when it does get into that signpost thing, I'm reminded of Roger Corman's Fantastic Four when Johnny Storm takes flight and it is a cartoon. I mean, it is that level of differentiation.
And that might have been intentional. When Neo, you know, he's supposed to jump off the building in that first film and he falls down and his arms are all waggling around and the ground, you know, is like rubber and goes in. The Wachowskis told the animators, watch Wile E. Coyote. That's what we want this to look like. So there, maybe there is something to the Looney Tunes idea.
But you know who I really want to give credit to for this fight is not the CGI animators, but man, Hugo Weaving. I know this guy, we gave him some credit for V for Vendetta. We're going to be talking about him at some point with Lord of the Rings, but I was watching his performances in this, and I can't imagine how many days he had to spend with like a second unit. Okay, stand up. Now stand up differently. Now stand up differently and snarl. And to do all these performances that had to be composited on top of each other, the man must have the patience of Job.
Well, and they also would set up the same shot, you know, have the cameras on rigs so they could always move the same way, and he would just walk in from a different place, or, you know, and they'd overlay all those effects. I mean, they, again, there's a lot of great work here. They created full 3D virtual sets that you cannot tell are fake for a lot of this action. I think with the humans, it's easier to tell that. But yeah, he did a lot of work to be this Smith. And I do love, we get that early reveal that something's going on with Smith. He drops off his earpiece and thanks Neo for unplugging him. And this idea that Smith has been freed by Neo, you know, Stuart, you said, oh, it's Jesus versus the devil. I think there's something different here. It's not that simplistic. Smith is almost like Neo. He is the one, except here he is the many. He could duplicate himself, but he wants to destroy the Matrix too.
It is yin and yang. It is the one versus the many. He is the anti-Neo.
Right. There's some lip service paid to that, but I do feel like this is the relationship that has the most carryover from the Christian imagery and iconography that we had last time. Yeah, that's how I'm taking Smith at this point. He's a fallen angel. He's something that used to work for the system that has been cast out. He is perverting the people. I mean, he sticks his fingers into people's stomachs and they get that kind of, you know, oily mirror look about them, and then they become a version of him. To me, this feels like the corruption of souls. I feel like whatever you want to call it in computer language, when you look at it back through the lens of it being a religious film, yeah, this is the devil. This is the evil character that Neo is going to have to face. If he is Jesus, then this is the devil.
Yeah, but I see this devil doing the same mission. It's a perverted, twisted way. He is freeing people. He overrides him with that mirror effect that we saw override Neo when he was freed from the Matrix. He wants to destroy the Matrix. I think it goes a little bit deeper than good versus evil here.
Well, what's happening to them? I imagine that the people in the pod die. I have nothing to base that on. It is purely my speculation. But my feeling is, watching the agony that they go through and the fact that they literally become him, I feel like they're dead at this point. It's a dead battery.
That was my assumption too. I remember that third film well. They're not going to explain it. And I always assumed they would just die, but we saw a character early on, Bane. He gets that oily Smith effect over him, and he's still alive. He comes out of the Matrix with his brain rewritten.
Yeah, I think we see it in Bane. They do not die. They just become possessed. And keep in mind, in the first movie, Smith was taking over people as well. People who are plugged into the Matrix.
Temporarily,
but this is a longer term. This is the first time we've seen him duplicate versus teleport, but I thought it was the same kind of thing. It's just a program gone amok.
The Oracle basically spoke to that. In explaining herself, she was also explaining all phenomenon. And it even ties back to that Animatrix episode with the haunted house and the girl looking for her cat, is that if there is something weird in this world, if you feel like you've seen an angel or a ghost or a vampire or a werewolf, you have, but it isn't real because it's just programming that has gone bad. I kind of like that as a concept.
I love this idea. I mean, if you've studied Hegel, the philosopher, there's so much Hegel going on in these films where you have the thesis and the antithesis, and then you come up with the synthetic. And so I love this idea that, no, there's not really ghosts or the supernatural. They're just bad programs. That's how, like, how we're actually going to explain it. That's the synthetic idea coming from straight programs and crazy mythology. I was really hoping to get vampires and werewolves in this film. We're not.
We do.
Well, we kind of do.
We're about to get there. Yeah, we don't. They don't go full in, and I think it would be too many cooks in the kitchen if you brought in too many supernatural beings, but we will get ghosts.
Hey, they made that fucking movie. They called it The Underworld.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Maybe The Underworld is happening in The Matrix as well.
That's why it looks so much like this film.
They dress it.
Anyway, it is a cool concept. I like it. It reinforces that Animatrix episode that we watched last week. I'm grooving on this concept.
I was surprised they brought back that Animatrix thing. That was like the whole thing I was getting out of that entire speech is, oh my god, that Animatrix episode was based on something. But then when we see these rogue programs later in the movie, I'm like, all right, where's the bulldozer?
You know, yeah, we're going to get to the Merovingian. What I find myself, if you listen to Pitch Black, when we got to that second film, I'm like, hell no, I don't want to be roll in my six-sided die and get into all this mythology. Just give me a story. I don't typically get involved in these worlds. There's like Star Wars and Lord of the Rings. That's it. I'm invested. Those are the two fantasies I could get into. For other films, just tell me a straight story. I don't want to know the 60 different factions going on and who's fighting who. I find this film overcoming that bias, which for me, it's doing something right. When you're getting into this idea that there's, you know, rogue programs running around and they're actually vampires and, you know, you have the Oracle and she's a machine and you got Smith whose code has been rewritten by Neo. Like, you're getting all this expanded mythology inside the Matrix. I find myself actually enjoying this and wanting more.
Oh, I'm the opposite on this one. When they get to the Merovingian, I'm just going to call him the Frenchman because to me, he's the Merolynchian permanently. When they get to this Frenchman is when I am saturated and I don't want this except in very few universes. You mentioned Star Wars. I'll go Star Wars and Marvel. I'll take some expanded universe content for this. But here, this feels like they're prepping for the novel series. They're prepping for the video games. And I don't know that any of this is integral to the story of what's happening, nor does it make any sense to me. I don't think it's well explained why programs go rogue. I tended to think of the machines as the Borg, all one mind, all one machine, because logic is logic. 0 + 1 = 1 always.
That's the fascinating thing here is that you said in your plot summary, you know, machines break down. You gotta, you know, reboot. Here we see these programs breaking down or they're outmoded. They came out with a better program and now they're hiding. They're exiles and they go to the Merovingian to, you know, be hidden away somewhere in the Matrix so they can't be deleted. I find this stuff fascinating. I love this like modern mythology based on computer systems and I find this all very interesting.
All I know is I'm really hungry for some chocolate cake. When we get to the Frenchman. This is a notorious scene. This is another scene where when people were complaining to me all summer long about how they didn't like the Matrix, this was one of those scenes they didn't like. I always thought it was kind of cool. There is something sort of butterfly effect about seeing someone who can calculate an emotional reaction out of someone through what seems like an innocuous choice.
You wanted chocolate cake. I wanted some cherry pie.
Well, you get both here with the beautiful blonde woman having a bite that makes her orgasm. This is strange stuff.
No, it doesn't make her orgasm. I think it just gets things going. That's why she's so willing to suck the Merovingian's cock.
It explodes and she's super horny because she just orgasmed. Right? Women are different than men. Reorgasm, we want to turn over and go to bed. It's different for a woman. They want to keep going.
That's exactly the way that I took it. And yes, it shows that this character should be a really cool villain because he's 10 steps ahead of you. He's like a chess player. You know, you're talking to him here in this restaurant, but he's already thought about how he's going to defeat you down the street hours from now. I like this as a concept, but the simple fact of the matter is, in this movie at least, the Merovingian doesn't really do much else except be French, except sip wine and get blowjobs.
What's wrong with that?
Well, I find he's a very unsatisfying villain. They've got to fight him, essentially, to get to the Keymaker. And Arnie, if you keep wanting to call him the Merovingian, I keep wanting to call the Keymaker the Keymaster. I'm thinking of Rick Moranis and Ghostbusters the whole time. But I just feel like I want this to be a good battle. This cake confection setup is strange, but I like it, and it makes him feel very distinct and Machiavellian, is how I think of him. But then he just becomes kind of a stupid character in the rest of this middle section here. I actually think the worst scene in the entire movie comes after this restaurant scene where Persephone, a character I will never understand, goes and shoots werewolves and is like, well, here's the key maker. He's just in a room with a bunch of keys and apparently none of them open the damn door.
I thought you were going to say the worst scene is where in order to give them the key maker, she demands Neo kiss her like he kisses Trinity. And I'm like, with absolutely no chemistry?
I'm throwing that in there. Yeah, that's all the badness. Yes, that stretch of film there, that 5 minutes, is just awful.
I don't know. I disagree. There's something so damn stiff about these good guys. I love the Merovingian. Like, here is finally, you know, besides the Oracle, here's someone with personality. Here's someone having fun. And I really do think, you know, you're wondering why Persephone acts the way she does. If you play the video game.
Please don't make me.
This is what I was talking about. Yeah, I suspected all of this made sense in the video game.
No. It really doesn't. But, like, Persephone stealing a kiss, that's just her deal. You get to see her and Jada Pinkett Smith make out in that that video game. So you might want to play it if that's your thing.
I see. Yeah, I mean, okay. Well, that's disappointing to know that there is not a more satisfying story for her character floating out there in the ether. I suspected that was the justification for this. Because, yeah, Monica Bellucci, very beautiful woman, nothing to do in this film. Just absolutely nothing.
I don't know. I'm not questioning her motives. These are programs that are bored. They're power players. They are the king and the queen. And yeah, so she wants to steal kisses and feel alive again. I wish that was more convincing. I wish I cared about Trinity and Neo's relationship.
Oh,
I think the music works and how it swells up, but I don't know if that second kiss is any better than the first. But Persephone, when she walks in and she's just shooting him, here's the keymaster. She's playing a game just like her husband's playing a game and getting blowjobs in the bathroom. And she, again, here's this idea of these programs. They want to feel alive. Persephone tells Neo, you know, my husband was once like you. I do wonder if he was an early version. Maybe he was the first version of Neo in the Matrix. Who knows?
I didn't take it to be the one. I just took it to be he, you know, was a little less aloof, a little less idealistic, and a little bit more in the now and all of that.
It could be. I mean, again, I don't know if I need a backstory for all these lines dropped. I think they hint at things that make it a more interesting story. Because so much of this now is a video game. We're going to go to the Merovingian, then we're going to get the Keymaker, we're going to fight some ghosts, we're going to go on the freeway. It is so video game. I just like these little drops here and there that there is a bigger mythology.
But there's too much mythology. There's too much packed in here. We've got so many characters that when we get to Persephone and the Merovingian, that I just don't care. Because what about Locke? What about Bane? What about Niobe? What about Link? What about Z? I could actually go for 5 minutes of this podcast. What about the kid? What about Ice? What about Red Shirt or whatever his name is?
I didn't care about any of those characters. They had no personality. These characters have personality.
Well, here's the question. What matters? What is the storyline that matters? I honestly don't know. We've been told that we should want this Keymaster to be freed. Now that he is, I don't know what they're doing. They go into a spectacular car chase to nowhere. They are literally driving to nowhere. There's no reason they need to drive anywhere. There's no reason they need to go fast. They are just trying to stall time till they can figure out where to go next.
No, they're escaping the ghost albinos to speed to where they can get an exit and exit the Matrix.
Yeah, Arnie, I understand that. But you understand my point, that they are literally driving around for no point. They're on a freeway. They should be heading somewhere. This story should be moving towards something, and it's not. It is jumping around. It is very scattered.
I'm not with you on that one.
I would damn it the other way. It's so video game-like, where you've completed this objective, now here's the next level. I think now they got to escape and get to a phone so they could get out of the Matrix and be safe, and oh, you're going to have to go on the freeway. You're never supposed to go on the freeway. It's dangerous. You know, I don't know. I feel it's rote.
I'm not making any links between this guy with a bunch of keys and stopping all of the squids from invading Zion. I'm not making any of these links. We're an hour into the movie.
Again, it all goes back to the Oracle. This is the mission she sent him on. If you want to win, if you want to end the war, you got to get this guy and you got to go into this building and open this door and then it will be over.
Well, we haven't gotten to the building with the door. Yeah, now that's next. This is this short-sighted thinking about, I'm only going to tell you apparently what you need to know because you don't deserve to know what the plot is.
We could argue about this all day. I think that's part of the point. She says you can't understand anything beyond the choice you have made. They don't understand why they're doing this. The Merovingian calls them out. You don't even know why you're here. You don't know why you need the Keymaker. You're just told you do. So therefore, tuttle off, be gone. I think that is part of the message, that these people don't know what they're doing. They're following orders.
Just because the script calls out bad motivation for characters does not suddenly make a good motivation for characters.
Right. It's postmodern, but it's also just poorly scripted. That's exactly right, Arnie. In a screenwriting class, you would get an F for handing this in, because this is not how characters grow and change and tell stories. This is not a story being told. This is a, shuttling around between a world.
But I'm going to come down between the middle of you two on this one. I'm going to say that I agree with Stuart that this is poor storytelling, and it is just a lot of go from point A to point B. It's not plotting. It is video game level of thought. But I'm also going to come down with Jacob that I kind of like some of the world building, and I definitely like all of the action. I mean, I like the fight Neo does with the sword against the Merovingians. henchmen, but that car chase, I'll just come out and say it right now. I wasn't sure if I was recommending it until I saw the goddamn car chase. That fucking thing is amazing. That is, I got so kinetic. It doesn't matter that they're going to nowhere because my adrenaline is pumping. There are scenes when I thought I was getting hit by a truck.
You know, I talked about with the first film, they built that four-story set and the helicopter where they got to save Morpheus. They built a mile-and-a-half freeway for this film. Like, they couldn't find one. It was just too difficult, and I could totally get it. They were actually offered, like, in Ohio or something, a freeway that they could film on, and they're like, it's just going to be impossible when you have to reset the cars. And so they built a mile-and-a-half freeway.
I remember two things about that. First of all, I remember somebody getting arrested for drunk driving because they knew this fake freeway was there. They got intoxicated and just were speeding like a son of a bitch on it. And I also remember, didn't somebody die during this? I believe there were some actual fatalities during the filming.
I don't know. I didn't come across. They didn't put that as an extra, the people who died. It is fascinating, though, if you have the extras on DVD or Blu-ray, they show a lot of how they film this. It was difficult. You know, we talked about the bullet time. They would be filming a lot of these action scenes with like two or three different cameras at different speeds so they could do all this slow motion. And okay, there's some obvious CGI. Again, when they have that agent jumping on the car, doesn't look great, the human. But that car, they actually had a mechanical device that like caved in the hood and flipped it. I mean, that is all real. And to watch them film that and have to abort it a couple times because cameras weren't working, and then the Wachowskis are like, okay, let's do it again, and they got to reset. I mean, this is a marvel to watch. I totally agree with you, Arnie. This is what wins me over, finally. If I'm kind of enjoying it, this is what really puts it over the top, is just the adrenaline you get from this entire freeway scene.
Yeah, and then we're all in agreement here. This is a great action movie. Whatever Reloaded ends up being, Red Arrow or Green Arrow, no complaints at all about these kinds of scenes. And I want to just compliment. I think I might even like the fight on the staircase before they get on the freeway even more. I just think that there is real beauty to the way that the art direction, the costuming, the choreography, and to a lesser degree, the computer-generated effects all work together to create these action scenes. It's great stuff here. As an action movie, this movie is wildly successful. And so, yeah, I'm totally enjoying this movie whenever it's shutting the fuck up and letting the characters fight. But I would be lying to say there is a little voice in the back of my head going, where are they going? What's going to happen next? I don't understand. And there is a little bit of Darth Mauling happening here too, right? They got these cool ghost twins. They can kind of go underneath the ground, and they got the dreadlocks and all of this. I'm thinking that these might be an enemy that are going to carry over to the third one. They even had their own poster. I remember being in a movie lobby and seeing those and going, oh, that's going to be badass. Or they're just going to die here and we'll never see them again.
I don't even think they died. That's what doesn't make sense. We could see that if they turn into a ghost before a bullet hits them or a sword hits them, well, it just goes through them. So when we see Morpheus, I do love this great samurai move against an SUV. And don't drive SUVs, they flip over easily. They're always flipping over in this freeway scene. But you know, he takes out the tire, shoots the gas tank, it blows up. They turn into ghosts. We see them yelling. I don't know. Maybe they Pac-Man ate them and they had to go back to their little home to recuperate.
See, I thought that they were killed by fire. I mean, fire kills everything is how I take it.
Even ghosts.
Yes.
Yeah, there was something. I think it was the fact that they were caught unexpected. If they have enough time, they can go into ghost mode and nothing physical can hurt them. But I think because they didn't see it coming and they had a material reality while they were driving in the van. This is totally me reaching here, but that's the way I took the reason why they could die, was they weren't ghosts in the moment that the van exploded.
And I kind of liked the little bit, and I was thinking back to like Star Trek about how you can have a cloaking device so that nobody can see you, but you have to uncloak to shoot. That's kind of how it was with these ghosts, is they can't hurt you when they're ghosty, but you can't hurt them when they're ghosty. So if they're hurting you, if you can make them ghost, you're safe. And I really, just the kineticness of how the ghost had to finally ghost out and then be pushed out of the car by inertia, and he reformed in his brother's car. It's just really exciting. When Trinity gets on that motorcycle is when it ramps up.
That is the best stuff for me, because I think it's the stuff that's most real or the least reliant on the CGI, is when she's driving against traffic. I mean, I don't think that that's faked.
There's parts that are real, but a lot of it was fake. They just had little markers in the ground so the stunt woman knew where to swerve,
oh,
and then they put
God.
CGI cars later. But there were some parts where she was actually driving against traffic, but the real dangerous stuff, all faked.
Believe me, I've been on the freeways here in LA, and I've thought about, like, what if I just went into the other lane and it could finally move, but... Man, this scene has convinced me to just stay in my lane. This stuff is scary.
They even call this freeway the 101. If you live in LA, you know how bad the 101 is.
I know what that is. Yep, I surely did. I didn't know that this was a fake freeway, but yeah, bravo. This was always the centerpiece. I remember this was the hype of this movie, was that there was going to be a freeway chase to end all be all. I don't think it may rank as my favorite of all time. I'd have to really think about that one and revisit a lot of movies, but it's clearly the centerpiece to this Matrix trilogy. It is the action scene that you will remember, I think, out of all of it.
And I agree with everything we've said. I just want to put out there, though, man, is it slightly too long?
Well, what really puts it over is when we get this whole Morpheus scene on top of the 18-wheeler. He's fighting one of the agents mm-hmm. and flipping. And I get it. He knows that physics are fake and he's able to break things. But the way he's flipping and there's still truck for him to land on and that... In a film that stretches credibility, this one really stretches credibility for me. Maybe it's that it just doesn't look that great, too. It does look too green screen.
Yeah, a little bit. But you know what? I like Morpheus to get his moment. This is the scene for him. Trinity is basically running away on a bike. She's doing stunt work. He's doing the fighting. Neo is kind of sitting this one out. They put him out on a mountain, and he's got to fly there. So for most of this, he's not present. I feel like, yay, Morpheus gets a battle. What I don't like is that they got a shoehorn in for reasons I don't even understand, a Jada Pinkett Smith catch-all. You know, she's just got to drive up and save his ass once, because I guess if they're paying her, she's got to do something in this story.
You know, I really do wonder how much they told her footage would be in the film, because so much footage in that video game of her, you know, her having to get back into the Matrix and having to get a car to go save Morpheus. You want that whole story? Play the video game. I really do wonder if they're like, oh yeah, no, this is all going to go in the movie, and then they just took all her stuff out to put it in the game.
She is who I was thinking of when I was referring to earlier about characters and them must having a much more interesting life beyond the scope of this film. It's got to be her. She's not a huge star, but she is a name recognizable person in a role that could be as essential as one of these main characters. And I don't see her doing anything to earn the screen time. I don't know why I should care. And I'm trying. Believe me, I like the outfit. It's a good look on her, but she's not earning it.
The only scene of hers that seems to matter to me in this whole movie is where she defies her boyfriend / husband. I don't know if she's married or just living with or dating Locke, but when Locke is so anti-Morpheus and she's just like, well, fuck you, I'm gonna go out after my ex-boyfriend. That seems to be her big scene in this movie, and the rest of it, she matters to me as much as any of those other characters that you didn't say matter, Jacob.
Right, exactly. Mifune or Kid or any of those people I didn't recognize, and her I do, so why do I feel like her part is no better than theirs?
Yeah, go play, I guess, Enter the Matrix. Her and Ghost, she has an Asian counterpart on that ship. They really take over that video game, and they get a lot more scenes there.
Well, unlike Stuart, I actually dislike Jada Pinkett Smith, so I will not be playing that game.
There is a sexy scene of her making out with Persephone.
But I just don't like Jada Pinkett Smith.
That's saying a lot when you don't want to watch her make out with another girl.
Yeah, it is. Especially on a pixelated 2003 video game.
No, this isn't pixelated. This is actual footage. This is the actual actresses.
Is it on the disc as a bonus feature?
It is a bonus feature on the disc.
All right, I'll just watch that.
Can I just ask, why are they making out? Is there a reason given? I know why. No, I'm not dumb. I know why they're making out. Is there a story-centric reason for them to lock lips?
You know, I only get the cutscenes on that bonus. I think they're actually trying to find out where Morpheus is, and when they get back in and they have to save him. And so they go to that same Merovingian restaurant and they run into Persephone and she says, I'll tell you where they are if you give me a kiss.
Okay. So no. Yeah, I get it. This is a sexually charged movie, and I can kind of appreciate that. Like I said, they want to show that humanity is different from machines for this reason. I wonder if it's any good, because I just feel like these Wachowskis would be terrible at porn. They have a way of making everything feel cold and not sexy.
How was Bound? I've never seen Bound.
Bound was hot. Bound was fucking hot.
It was. You're right. That's a good point, is they've done it well before. So why isn't this working for me in that way? I don't know. but to be settled another time. You know what I keep doing every time I run into one of these little things, and I did it back in summer 2003 when someone griped at me, I don't know why they did this, or I don't understand that. I just say, well, they'll explain it in the next one. We've still got another movie for them to justify anything that feels out of place.
I'm just going to go ahead and say, because I don't want to relive The Matrix 2 and Part 3 and say, did they answer this? Did they answer that? Did they answer this other thing? No. No.
But I believe it, you know, and I do think that's going to be crucial to my recommend or not, is how much of this can stand on its own and how much is predicated on Matrix 3 finishing what got started.
And Stuart, when I walked out of this movie in 2003, that's where I was standing, is I didn't know. If we'd been recommending and not recommending in 2003, I walked out of this theater going, I'm sure the next one's going to make it all pay off. There was so much set up here. I'm sure the next one. We'll talk about that next week, but that's where I stood when this movie came out in theaters, is I couldn't review this as a solo film. This time, I have to. But there's one last scene we really have to talk about. It's when Colonel Sanders shows up.
Yes, Act 3.
This actor, the architect, he originally tried out to be one of the councilmen. They're like, no, we want you to be the architect. So he's like, great, I get to do my Orson Welles impression.
Oh, that's a cool, yeah, that is kind of what he's doing. How funny. This was literally, well, maybe not literally, but it felt like a literal head spin for me. This movie had been so slow and talky, and here was a scene that I literally wish that they had just stopped and he spoke slower, because so much is dumped on here.
This movie was made for video. This movie was not made for the theatrical experience we all had, because this scene is incomprehensible, because there's so much going on. There's a million Neos. I mean, again, I was talking about what Hugo Weaving had to do. Keanu had to film all these different takes of his own reactions. It's visually exciting, but there's so much of a data dump. I feel like this movie is meant for what I did. I watched the movie to the end and I'm like, we gotta figure out what the fuck he said. Rewind. Oh wait, I got distracted by that Neo in the background. Rewind. What the fuck? Rewind.
You know, I get it. Yes, this is something that works if you watch it multiple times and you want to pay attention to every Neo's reaction. I don't know. I thought I got 80% of it when I watched it in the theater. Yes, it's dense. I think you could get the basics off of one viewing, but there is a whole lot more, and we're going to get into it now.
You got to be paying real close fucking attention to get it on one viewing.
Well, I was. I was drawn into this film the first time I watched it.
It feels very contrary. It feels like every time he's like, oh, so is this what it all means? No, it means this. Oh, so it's like that. No, it means this. I just feel like every time I feel like I got my grasp on this. This is where the title comes into play. This is The Matrix Reloaded. We have learned that they reload our universe. And this is a concept of our own universe, is that we are in this perpetual cycle of expansion and retraction, and that everything that's existed will collapse in on itself and perhaps come back in a new molding each time. Fascinating concept here. There have been six of these. Is every time, is it Keanu Reeves?
No, it's just whoever happens to be. They don't even know who it's going to be. Okay. There's just somebody who breaks the code.
Right. They know that there is a one, and they can't put his picture up in the post office with a wanted poster, but they know it when they see it. He is the one, but the one is never destined to win. They just believe that they're going to win.
I love this. Jesus Christ is bullshit. It's basically what it's saying. It is a construct. It is there, you know, because we can't build a perfect world, because humans will reject it. We got to have this unperfect world. 1% are going to reject it. And eventually we have this anomaly, you know, that shows up as the one, this Messiah. And no, his job is to betray the entire earth, not save it, to kill everyone in Zion except for 23 people.
Well, he doesn't actually kill that, but
the robots do. I mean, yeah. they eliminate Zion.
But he doesn't even need to tell them where Zion is. I mean, they know all of this. His only job, and I don't even know why he has to be the one to do it, is to pick the 23 people who will create a new Zion so that it can all start over. And what I love is that the Oracle, she, for the first five times, was completely in on it. Her job was to find the one and make him go to the architect and do it all again. She was completely complicit five times, and the sixth time, well, that's why we have a movie.
Or maybe that's why we have a third film, because that's how I take it in this film. She is leading Neo. That's why it's a video game adventure. Hey, you got to find this guy who has a key. Why is this so difficult to get to the architect? You know, they got to find the Keymaker. They got to knock out all the power in the city. They got to open this door at the precise time. It's lined with explosives. You know, I really figure, okay, if they could kill the one and not have to worry about it, they'll make it as difficult as possible. But if you could get to the architect, okay, we really know this is the one. But I don't know if the Oracle is doing anything different this time than she's done five times previous.
She's neither good nor bad. She is just an enabler for the one to have his moment with the architect. Okay, I think the architect comes back in the next movie, but I feel like this is the only scene where we really get any kind of understanding about him. Is he a program then? Is he written by computers?
Yes, he is the program that was created to create the Matrix.
Right. So in essence, he should be like the Borg Queen, right? He should be the advocate. He is, the way I took it is, he is for the robots what Councilman Hanam was for the Zionists. That they are representatives, they embody the spirit of the side that's fighting the other side. And so that it's really, it's Councilman versus Architect, it's Neo versus Smith, that there are all of these sort of yin-yang kind of pairings that are going on here.
And I don't know if it's that simplistic.
But it should be.
I don't think it should be. Here is, again, I think the point of the Matrix, you know, now we find out there's ghosts and vampires and programs running around doing their own thing.
So the architect really sucks.
Quality control is not his bag.
He's Microsoft.
I think it's showing that this isn't about black and white. This is about worlds created by worlds upon worlds upon worlds. It's not just recreated the machines, but now the machines created this matrix, and now that is growing independent of their creator. This is, it's turtles all the way down. I love this idea that, again, no, I don't think this is Locke versus the architect. I think these are different factions and they're all self-motivated. Now, yes, this is an AI program. He's very logical, very mathematical. The Oracle is very different. It's intuitive and he's there to balance this equation. And Neo, they're supposed to take apart his code to figure out how to build an even better matrix where a one won't arise next time.
Right. This is, okay, then I mostly understood this. I feel like I didn't, even though I watched it for the second time. I feel like I didn't understand the scene, but I think I largely get it then. Okay, so this is basically Neo finally getting the answer, the only answer he's ever going to get from the machines as to why he's fighting in this battle. And it's humbling, and he's played into their plan all along, and now he's going to be freed so that he can go watch Trinity die or not die.
Well, he makes the choice. Yeah, he's got to make the choice to either go and reload the Matrix and have Zion wiped out except for 23 people, or he could go back out and continue to be Neo, and it's going to shut down the Matrix. It's going to crash. It's going to kill every human hooked up to it, plus Zion is going to get destroyed. That's his choice.
What's the advantage of doing the other way? Help me. What would that look like if he hadn't gone to save Trinity?
Zion would be destroyed. All humans would die. 23 people would be woken up out of the Matrix and told that it's basically just happened. Because let's keep in mind, if this has happened six times, you know, in the last movie, they say this is $21.99. But now we're finding out we're like in $27.99 or something along those lines. So it may even be the 30th century. And so those 23 people would go down and have a lot of sex and start a human resistance movement that would last for another, you know, 100 years or so. And when they get too big, it happens again. And the Matrix, meanwhile, would reboot probably back to 1996 or whatever. Everybody in the Matrix, their minds would be wiped. They'd be put back at 1996 time. And life goes on as it has been.
But because he didn't do that, now what's going to happen?
Zion is going to be destroyed, and the Matrix is going to crash like a bad computer, and all humans die, so total genocide of the human race.
That's the threat, at least.
Okay. So is it better to have 23 eking out an existence than the certainty, or at least certainty as it's been told six other times, but this time it's for real? I think that's what is the difficulty here, is if it keeps repeating, if it keeps revolving, as it were, can't he just try the next time? Why does this one have to crash? Or why does it have to be in guarantee that the machines are going to win this time? I don't know that I can buy into that line of thinking.
I just said that, you know, oh, the Oracle's evil. She planned all this. She led Neo here. Here's where I actually go back on that. The reason Neo makes a different choice this time, and the architect calls it out, before you have felt a general type of love for humanity, this time it is very specific. There is one person you really love, Trinity. That was all set up, though, I feel like, by the Oracle. She told Trinity, you know, like, you'll fall fall in love with the one. That is the one differing factor here. So maybe the Oracle has something else up her sleeve. That, again, I like that you're not quite sure. Now we'll have to see if that all comes into play in the next film, but I find this fascinating that this is so multifaceted, that because he has a specific love this time, that's the difference. That's why he is willing to not reset the system and only save 23 people. Again, he is not the Jesus that's going to save humanity. He is going to risk all of humanity for one person.
Right. He's self-centered as opposed to thinking of others.
But I do want to point out, it's not just 23 people he'd save. It's 23 people unplugged to the Matrix, plus millions of people in the Matrix. So really, yes, it's all of humanity in his hands.
I see. I sort of see. I mean, I get it as much as I need to, although I really have to believe that there had to be a way of streamlining these ideas and conveying them in a way that didn't require seven viewings.
I don't know if the Wachowskis wanted to do that, though. I'm sure it could be done.
It helped the DVD sales.
Yes.
Yeah.
I get that they wanted to make something that you would get new ideas from and watch every time, but I think you always want to kind of understand what's going on. And I remember my first viewing after this architect scene, I had no idea what was going on.
Well, it wouldn't be a now playing if we didn't bring up 9/11, right? So let me do that. Obligatory 9/11 reference. This movie came out in 2003.
This is when we went to war with Iraq.
Yeah.
For the second or third time.
But yet, the Wachowskis must be pretty staunch Democrats, because when the architect is discussing the grotesqueries of the human nature, both Bush Sr. and Bush Jr. are on the wall.
Yeah, I got that it wasn't really a political statement. They showed all the living presidents that would have existed within the Matrix somewhere on those screens. They showed Hitler, too. I mean, I think they were just trying to show world leaders.
I didn't see Clinton in there. I did not see Clinton.
Well, go watch it in an eighth time, frame by frame, and maybe you'll see him.
And these guys did make V versus Vendetta. I mean, they were involved with the creation of that. I think you're right. I think that their political bias does show through, and whether that hurts this film for you or not, I can't say. But I definitely get that leaning on it.
If nothing else, they gave each of the Bushes like eight screens. If Clinton was on one, I missed it.
Yeah, I remember seeing Bush and Hitler. And you draw a parallel when you see people put in that close succession. But okay.
Now, let's get to the thing that when I watched this in theaters left a real bad taste in my mouth, though, is because Trinity is this whole scene with the architect. I think they made one really bad editing choice. In the beginning, they keep cutting to Trinity breaking into this other building or trying to break out of the building after she cut reserve power because everybody else died in it. And so when we're supposed to really be focused on the architect and Neo, every so often we cut to Trinity. And I know on the one hand, it maybe trying to break up a talkie scene with a little bit of action, but I'm far more interested in the architect's new words than more of Trinity's wire foo and crane kick. But she gets shot and killed. Man, I hate it when you come back to life. Neo came back to life last time. Neo's so goddamn powerful that now death completely ceases to matter.
I don't know if it completely ceases. He has to do a lot of work. He's got to, shove his hand in her and rip out the bullet and pump her hard. You know, I get that they're trying to do with the reverse of the last film where Trinity saved him. Now he's saving her because they're yin and yang. And I really feel like there's not the one without a Trinity.
She even says, I guess we're even now. So it hits you over the head with that frying pan.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, they didn't even want to commit to that scene, so they show it through code.
It's okay. I don't want to commit to that scene either.
Yeah, it's groan-inducing. I mean, all this dialogue, all this love banter. It's curious. They want to believe that love is the answer for giving this society a new option. You know, I think all of that's cool, but do they actually believe it? It doesn't come through on the screen. I don't believe that the Wachowskis are romantics, even though they're really trying to train themselves to be.
Let me just say, if right now I'm doing this podcast in the Matrix and I'm somewhere in a red goo-filled pod and I'm about to die because he went after this bitch, I'm pissed.
Maybe you've already been taken over by Smith and you're having a lot of fun kung fu fighting.
And then we're left on a cliffhanger. I mean, I think I could have suspected that, and given that you didn't have to wait very long for the next movie. It was going to be out in 6 months, so they've reserved the right to leave us hanging, as it were. But they really do leave us hanging here in these last scenes. I mean, they blow up the Nebuchadnezzar.
Yeah, Morpheus, he is shocked. He says, I have dreamed a dream, but now that dream is gone from me. That actually is a quote from Nebuchadnezzar in the Bible.
I thought it was a quote from Les Miserables, but whatever.
The Bible came first.
Okay.
I don't care so much about the Nebuchadnezzar, because now there's a ton of ships, you know? I don't have an attachment to the Nebuchadnezzar. But I did get a little freaked out when Neo starts displaying his one power in the real world. And he holds up his hands and stops the sentinels like he can stop bullets in the Matrix. That is a escalation that I did not see coming. And I'll be goddamned, no matter what I thought of this movie, when I see that, they have my money for the next ticket.
You know, I went on message boards right after this. I wanted to see what people were saying. I wanted to discuss it. The popular theory, of course, Matrix in a Matrix.
That was my thinking, too.
Yeah, now he has realized he's in another Matrix. He says something has changed. There's an early scene where the little Buddhist kid from the first film, you know, a spoon is brought to him as a reminder. Like, people thought, oh, that's a hint that he's still in another Matrix, because there's that spoon that could eat could bend in the actual Matrix we've seen before. That was the popular theory after this film.
Oh, wow. See, and again, I feel like that's a little too highfalutin. You know, can we just contain this and tell a story here? Do you really have to keep making us question things? Can't we ever feel comfortable about the way that you've led us down the path? Must we always say that this path is uncertain? I don't believe that it needs to be this hard to follow. I took it to mean, quite simply, something had transpired with the architect, and I didn't understand what had, that allowed him to bring that to wherever he went. He now was fully formed as this messiah because he can do it outside of it. Before, it's worth pointing out, at the beginning of Reloaded, there were a bunch of people that wanted him to heal their kid and perform miracles, and he couldn't do it in Zion. Now he's a character that can. It will have a physical toll, he'll fall into comas, but he is actually becoming... I feel like they've reset this so that I can perceive him as a messiah again.
Well, we will see what happens to that messiah in the third movie. But for this one, Jacob Stewart, do you recommend The Matrix Reloaded? Jacob.
You know, this film, in a lot of ways, doesn't work for me. I never really feel an attachment to many of the characters that I'm traditionally supposed to feel attached to, the heroes. I gravitate more towards the villains in this film. I think they're more fun. You got ghosts and vampires and the Frenchman and Persephone. And I think that is a problem, that I don't connect with what's supposed to be emotional moments. Link saying goodbye to Z. And I really think the point of the Matrix, and a lot of people don't like this, the Wachowskis are trying to do something more than just a straight action film. They want to do a lot of questioning, and they're going to throw some kung fu and motorcycle chases and gunfights in there, but they want to ask a lot of questions, and you might not be satisfied if you don't get all the answers. I like that they're asking all these questions. I've said it before. I studied philosophy in college. I minored in it. My degree has a philosophy emphasis in it, so I like all these ideas. I like all this philosophical pondering going on and the questions they're asking, and I like that after that first film, which again looked beautiful. I don't get what happened to the DP in this film. There's nothing that really looks beautiful. Like, every frame in that last film looked beautiful. Here it looks more rote to me, but I love all the questioning going on. I love all these ideas, and that it's taking that messianic story and saying, no, that is just another system of control. It's about knowing yourself, not knowing this mythological figure or that mythological figure. I think that's a great twist to do for a film that wants to ask questions. Is this satisfying as a stand-in-one story? No. I really think I see this as the beginning of where movies, didn't Kill Bill come out this year, where they really started just saying, hey, we're going to take one film and cut it in half. And you're not going to get a beginning, middle, and end, even if this is the middle part of a story. I feel like this has almost gone to that comic book model where you never get it done in one issue now. They're all 5 or 6 issues long. So it might not be satisfying on that end, but I think conceptually, I love this movie, the ideas it's coming up with, the questions it's asking, and that it's shoving all that into a sci-fi action film. So in a lot of ways, I like this one even more than the first. So I'm taking the green pill. It's a recommend for me.
Stuart.
It's the inverse of last time. Last time I said I was really really with the movie's ideas, and then it became sort of a rote action movie that I was just less jacked into, and that I enjoyed the first half more than the action stuff. And here it's the exact opposite. I feel like this philosophy, the ideas, are slipping into self-parody. I actually feel like the Wachowskis are becoming so discombobulated about where they want to go and what they want to make concrete that it makes this feel very messy. It makes it hard to root for any characters, and they're just frankly not any good at telling stories from the heart. This needed to be about ideas, and it's not. But I do think it is a gorgeous action movie. I think almost every fight scene in this is wonderful. And is that enough? I think I'm going to go with the green. It's on the line, and in some ways, it makes me have to treat the Wachowskis like Neo treats the Oracle. I'm just going to trust you. I don't know what the hell you're saying, but I'm going to trust you that this is going to be worth it, and that maybe I'll even feel this way next week, where I didn't like the ideas, but I like the action. If they can keep this consistent quality, I'll give them a pass. This will remain a green. But you know what? If the movie is as bad as I remember it next week, it could be enough for me to red arrow the whole franchise. So we'll see. I mean, the difficulty is it's predicated on getting answers I don't believe I'm going to get. So I'll just be satisfied with the action that I know that I have. And so that's a mild recommend.
And I was really on the fence. Coming back to this, when we discussed doing a Matrix retrospective, I'm like, there's one good fucking movie. Why are we going to do a retrospective for one fucking movie? Because my memory was walking out of this one and being very much like you, Stuart. It's kind of like what I did with RoboCop Prime Directives, is I got to see the next one to know what I'm really going to review this one, because the next one can make it all worth it. But I remember the next one now. And coming back, strangely enough, when I watched the next one in theaters, I walked out going, this is some shit. I'm so pissed off. The Matrix sucks. But knowing how that one ended when I watched this one did make this one more fulfilling. I agree with you, Stuart. This has some great action scenes. The car chase is my absolute favorite. The fight at the Merovingians is good. I love the fight against all the Agent Smiths, even though there is some obvious CGI hokery. I like even the fight against Seraph, even though that was fucking pointless.
Oh, come on! Eastern Kung Fu, that's how you know someone. I love that stuff, but I'm a Kung Fu fan.
Yeah, I love that line. Yeah, it was my favorite line in the movie.
It was a good line, but yet it was really unnecessary from a story point of view, and really Seraph doesn't have a character to investigate. And that is the weakness, is that really there are so many characters here that don't click with me, don't matter. So I'm stuck between good action sequences and characters that don't matter, and that puts me right on the line. I said it was the car chase when I went into the green, but what really firmed it up was the scene with the architect, because finally, when you flush away all of the shit that doesn't matter to me in this movie, it hooks me with the fact that it takes what we thought we knew about Jesus Neo and turns it on its ear as well. So I'm going to give this a recommend, and I'm surprised that I am, because I came back thinking I was going to red arrow this so hard that it was going to bleed for a week. But no, I'm giving it a green arrow, and I'm hopeful, because my memory was 2 was and 3 was ugh. So if I'm giving this one the pass this time, might I have been too harsh on 3 in theaters? Were my expectations too high? Maybe. I'm really looking forward now to revisiting it. I'm more excited to see The Matrix 3 now during this retrospective than I was when it came out in theaters.
You know what? I can't be tricked into thinking that what I'm going to get next week is going to be great. I suspect I'm not going to like it, but I do want to say this much. I'm having fun revisiting this franchise and where it goes off the rails and where it works for me, all of that. I just want to take a moment here at the end to say thank you to the donors. This has been a good series to go through. I have not thought about this in over a decade. So with your support and the support you give our podcast every week, just by listening and downloading, not just donating, you really, yeah, you make going back and watching these movies more fun than if I were just alone putting on a DVD. I mean, I think that it's helped complete the process for me of reviewing movies, is really knowing that there's an audience out there that wants to hear us discuss it and share in that discussion. So thank you, donors. We'll wrap it up next week.
So until next time, Tank, I need an exit.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible. Where we go from there is a choice I leave to you.
Once again, thank you for your support of Now Playing, and we hope you've enjoyed this episode in the Now Playing The Matrix retrospective series.
What was said was for you, and for you alone.
Your support helps keep Now Playing on the air.
You're my savior, man. My own personal Jesus Christ.
The Matrix films are the property of Warner Brothers Pictures, and no infringement is intended. Now Playing Podcast is not affiliated with the makers or distributors of these films.
You give me that juris my diction crap, you can cram it up your ass.
The opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated.
Not everyone believes what you believe.
My beliefs do not require them to.
Now Playing's The Matrix retrospective series is a Venganza Media production. Copyright 2014. All rights reserved. And no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.
Goodbye, Mr. Anderson.
We have a new character played by Henry Lennox. Anybody here watch Joss Whedon's Dollhouse? He was Boyd Langton.
Yeah.
I'm the only Whedonite here. All right.
Yep.
You are. Always.
The fight even against Serif. Serif? Seraphan?
Yeah, Serif.
I thought it was Serif, like sans Serif.
No,
Seraph's like an angel.
Seraphim is an angel, but they call him Serif here.
Okay, I thought it was Serif because it's a computer font.
No.
Okay.
It's an angel in the Bible.
It works both ways, actually.
Yeah. I love the idea that fonts are running around fighting. Damn you, Comic Sans. We're going to finally eliminate you.
I fight over fonts a lot in my day job. So
no,
good.
It's a popular thing.
I'm going to show Helvetica what's up.
Wingdings is where it's at, motherfuckers. So until next time, Tank, I need an exit.
Or should you say Link?
Yeah, Tank, I need a tank. Picky, picky, baby girl.